Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. Coming up on the show this week, from Australia, plans to build the country's biggest ever coal mine have ignited a fierce debate. At stake is the future of one of the country's best-known marine environments, the Great Barrier Reef, and also concerns over climate change. On the Thai-Myanmar border, we meet refugees who have spent generations living in camps. But first up, this week, Indonesia prepares to celebrate Independence Day, which marks 72 years of freedom from colonial rule. But in the far east of the country, some Papuans see Indonesia as a kind of colonial power. We speak with former political prisoner and Papuan activist Philippe Karma. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. This week, Indonesians are celebrating Independence Day. On the 17th of August 1945, the nation won independence after more than 300 years of Dutch rule and a short period under Japanese occupation during World War II. Every year, the country is covered in red and white national flags. Neighbourhoods gather together and play games, from sack races to contests climbing up giant poles and races to eat huge crackers, a favourite Indonesian snack. But not everyone is celebrating. In the far eastern corner of the country, some in resource-rich Papua are agitating for independence from the rest of Indonesia. In Jakarta, KBR Radio spoke with former political prisoner and Papuan activist Philippe Karma.
I'm Philippe Karma.
Philippe Karma dresses in an olive-green safari suit. His dreadlocked beard reaches from his chin down to his belly. The Morning Star flag is prominently displayed across his chest. That's a bold move. The Morning Star flag is the symbol of Papua's struggle for independence from Indonesia. And in 2004, Karma was sentenced to 15 years in prison for peacefully raising the flag. Under Indonesian law, it's still a crime to raise that flag. Without that freedom, Karma says he won't be celebrating Indonesian Independence Day.
Ya, 17 Agustus kami mengucapkan selamat merayakan hari kemerdekaan untuk teman-teman rakyat Indonesia.
For the 17th August, we wish our friends in Indonesian community a happy Independence Day. But we are not part of the Indonesian community. We are the Papuan community, the Papuan nation. We don't feel that it is our independence. In 1945, independence was from Sabang to Maluku.
Papua is in the far eastern side of Indonesia. When Indonesia won independence in 1945, Papua remained under Dutch control. In 1963, Indonesia seized control of the area. Papuans were promised a referendum where they would be able to choose between independence and being part of Indonesia. The referendum took place in 1969, but only a small number of Papuans were allowed to vote, just over 1,000, and it was under the threat of violence. Since then, Karma says Indonesian rule has been brutally enforced.
Jadi bagi orang Papua,
ever since we were forced to join Indonesia, we can be killed whenever the police and military want.
Orang Papua kapan saja bisa dibunuh.
Just earlier this month, Indonesian paramilitary police opened fire on a group of demonstrators on two occasions, killing one and injuring 16 others. The demonstrators were protesting over the death of their friend, who, after being pulled from a river, nearly drowned, died before getting medical care. Indonesian workers in the area refused to use their vehicle to transport him to hospital, and the delay proved fatal. Karma says this isn't out of the ordinary. It's part of a much larger pattern.
Yeah, kasus ini terjadi.
This case shows our friends outside and the international community what conditions are like for us in Papua from 1963 to now.
Andreas Hosono of Human Rights Watch Indonesia agrees that Papuans, especially outspoken ones, face ongoing violence.
Many of them were beaten, many of the women were raped, sexually abused, children also abused under Indonesian hand. Many of the leaders harassed, intimidated, some were killed. Disappearances is a major problem among Papuan activists. Many of the leaders, if they want to save their life, they have to do it overseas, whether in Papua New Guinea or Vanuatu Island, or of course Europe and the United States.
Papua is home to the world's largest gold mine and third largest copper mine. But despite the area's rich mineral resources, Papuans get few of its benefits. The Grasberg mine is run by American Indonesian company Freeport, and workers are brought in from other parts of Indonesia. Papuans are the poorest people in Indonesia. Indonesia's current president Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he's known, has promised to improve matters by developing infrastructure, including a massive road project, the Trans Papua. But Karma has his doubts.
Kami tidak peduli, kami tidak minta tentang Trans Papua.
We didn't ask for the Trans Papua. The Trans Papua is only built for the interests of business, who exploit Papua's wealth, like logging, legal or illegal. They need a road, also for military mobility. So the road is made for military mobility. We do not feel the benefits. Maybe there are benefits, but they are very small compared to the negative impacts.
In the meantime, Karma will continue to speak out despite the risks. And he says he's still waiting for Jokowi to fulfill the promise he made in his first few months as president, to end human rights violations in Papua.
Ya, kami menuntut yang pertama.
Our first demand is about Jokowi's promise from 26 December 2014. He said that he would resolve human rights violations in Papua in 6 months. But it is not over.
For Asia Calling, this report was compiled by KBR Radio Jakarta. Australia is one of the world's largest coal producers, exporting to Japan, China, South Korea, India, and Taiwan. After a fraught 7 years marked by controversy and opposition, a new coal mine has gained approval in the country's northeast. The Carmichael coal mine would be run by Indian mining giant Adani, and at an estimated value of $21.7 billion, it would be the country's largest ever coal mine. But the coal is to be exported via one of the country's most loved marine destinations, the Great Barrier Reef. And it's bound to have drastic environmental impacts. Many Australians are now asking what the real price of coal is. From Sydney, Jake Atienza explores the fierce debate that's unfolding.
Australia is renowned for its beaches. Every year, millions of tourists visit to get a taste of life in the self-proclaimed lucky country. And lucky it is. In terms of natural resources, Australia is one of the richest nations in the world. But many are arguing that the government's poor management of natural resources is simply lining the pockets of international mining companies and destroying the natural environment. The Carmichael coal mine on Australia's northeast coast has recently acquired government support and backing from investors. With an estimated lifespan of 60 years, the 28,000-hectare coal mine is projected to contribute up to $44.3 billion to the Australian economy. It would become Australia's largest coal mine. But the mine has tapped into a live debate in Australia and is facing overwhelming opposition from environment groups.
It's about having a safe climate, avoiding more extreme weather in the future, looking after the ocean in general and our forests, the health of our future generations.
That's Imogen Sethoven from the Australian Marine Conservation Society in Sydney.
These projects that are promoting fossil fuels actually not just jeopardise the Great Barrier Reef, but they jeopardise all the jobs along the reef coastline that are dependent on it.
As the world's biggest living structure and home to a diverse ecosystem of coral and marine life, the Great Barrier Reef is vulnerable to major land transformations brought about by mining. Australia has one of the world's most regulated mining industries, but Sethoven says the government is ignoring how coal mining contributes to climate change. An immediate transition to renewable energy should be the government's top priority. Supporters of the Carmichael coal mine say the project will boost jobs in an area facing high levels of unemployment. But Imogen says that renewable energy could provide those jobs instead.
We know that renewable energy is a huge job creator. If the Queensland government's target of 50% renewable energy by 2030 is to be achieved, then it will create between 6,400 and 6,700 jobs. They're in regional Queensland.
Meanwhile, Indian mining company Adani is seeking a $900 million Australian dollar loan from the Australian government to help finance the construction of a rail line to support the mine. Opponents argue that the government should not be using taxpayers' money to help fund a mine.
They should be funding things like renewable energy to actually stop us getting to dangerous global warming.
This is James Dagger, New South Wales coordinator of the Australian Youth Climate Coalition and leader of the hashtag Stop Adani campaign in Sydney.
We want to invest in infrastructure that supports a long-term economic benefit to the country. So, you know, building things like the renewable energy transition that we need.
70% of Australia's electricity comes from coal. But Mick Crow, director of Resource Industry Network, a peak body representing companies in the mining sector, says that the transition to renewables shouldn't be rushed.
There's no short-term available solution with power, with solar and wind, that those communities can pay for in the short term. If you want to not disturb the earth at all, well, then that's it, that we all have to change the way we live. But if we do want to actually do it, this is the right place to do it.
The place in question is the land of the Wangan and Jagalingo people.
We believe that we are not separate from the earth, not separate from the animals. Our spiritual and cultural connection ties directly to the places that we're trying to protect.
Marwa Johnson is spokesperson for the Wangan and Jagalingo Traditional Owners Council. They're the indigenous people who have cared for the land for tens of thousands of years, and they have consistently opposed the mine.
Our people still live in poverty. Nothing has changed. There is not one mining deal that we've previously agreed to that has benefited our people.
Johnson alleges Adani paid more than 200 Aboriginal people to pose as Wangan and Jagalingo people in an attempt to obtain consent to purchase 2,700 hectares of Wangan and Jagalingo land.
They do not have the right to supposedly consent to the destruction of that country.
The first hearing to settle the land dispute between Adani and the Wangan and Jagalingo people will take place in March 2018. It is the final challenge that could stop the Carmichael coal mine from going ahead. For Asia Calling, I'm Jake Atienza in Sydney, Australia.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. For six decades, Myanmar has faced civil war. Ethnic groups have been at the centre of that conflict, suffering persecution and violence. Forced to flee, hundreds of thousands of Myanmar's ethnic minorities now live as refugees in other parts of the world. On the Thai-Myanmar border, 100,000 people of the Karen ethnic minority live in nine refugee camps. Several generations live there now, and for the young ones, it's the only home they've known. With the 10-year ceasefire signed in Myanmar, the refugees may be repatriated soon. But they say there's nothing to return home to. Fighting continues in the villages, landmines are uncleared, and there are fears that the military have seized their land. Reporter Kanika Pechkau travelled to Mysod on the Myanmar-Thai border to find out more.
There's a sound of children singing a Korean folk song about their hometown in southern Myanmar. The Korean are one of Myanmar's 135 ethnic minority groups. In 1978, 1,000 Korean refugees arrived in Thailand's border towns. Many more have followed since then. They were fleeing fighting between the Myanmar army and armed ethnic insurgents fighting for independence. They came to Thailand seeking safety and expect to stay a few months. That was 40 years ago. Today, they're still here, unable to return to safety. Hai So Tago lives in Mela, the largest border camp. When I visited him, it was raining heavily. Here, more than 40,000 people live in a crowded collection of ramshackle bamboo huts, fenced in and guarded by Thai soldiers. He says the place feels oppressive.
It is a part of the environment and also, of course, a part of the world. It's like you are being put in a cave. You don't see the real moon or the real star or the sun. What you see is only the reflections within the cave. So it's difficult to picture whether this is a reality or not. So only until you move outside the cave, then you can see, oh, this is the real reflections of the true nature of the world.
Hai So Tago, now 36, was 6 years old when his parents left their hometown in Karen State. They spent days walking with him to the Thai border. Hai So says he was too young to remember it all. What he does remember is they promised him it would be a short visit. 30 years later, they are still here.
I don't have any kind of status, just refugees. So I don't have any birth certificate or I don't have any registrations either here.
Refugees stuck in Thailand like Hai So now face an uncertain future. Programs that promised resettlement in other countries have ended. Donors that once supported those in Thailand are moving their funds into Myanmar. New international crises have arisen, competing for the world's attention and sympathy.
We are trying to continue to advocate to the international donor, and we met with the embassy, especially Canada, US, and UK, and Australia, because now EU donors, most EU donors are leaving now, and they moved the office to Rangoon, to the Burma side.
A ceasefire agreement first signed in October 2015 was supposed to end 6 decades of civil war between the Myanmar government and ethnic minority groups. The refugees living in camps should be rejoicing. Instead, Hai So says they are stranded between a rock and a hard place. The world is telling them to go home, cutting back on the international aid that has kept them alive. But fighting around their villages continues. It's still not safe to go back. Meanwhile, survival in the camp become harder.
Our worry is food. Our main concern is if the people do not have enough food, then we may have a lot of problem in the camp, which may also affect to the neighboring area.
Refugees are unable to work and don't get a proper education. The Thai military has even stopped them leaving the camps. Half the refugees here were born and grew up in camps. 20-year-old Sehel says she can't imagine life in Myanmar.
I have never been there. I also was born in Thailand, and I have never been there. I don't know how can I do it, what I should do.
Thai army officials have warned the refugee camps will soon be shut down. Staying in a refugee camp isn't much of a life. But moving on doesn't seem to be an option either. For Sahel and the young generation of refugees, there is nowhere to go.
I'm not Thai or Myanmar. No one accepts me that I am their citizen. I not belong any country. I feel like I lose my hope and should I die or I don't want to do anything.
For Asia Calling, I'm Kanika Petgal in Mesot, Thailand.
The beaches of Timor-Leste are beautiful, with dramatic mountains that drop down to long white shorelines. But people are also cavalier about waste, throwing it away as they please. That's why one group, Movimento Tasimos, decided to stop complaining and just do something about it themselves. Each weekend, their gloves and masks come out and they hit the beach. Reporter Teodosia Dos Reis has this story from the capital, Dili.
It's dawn here in the capital, Dili, and the sun is just starting to peek up over the mountains. But on this white stretch of beach, a group of young Timorans is already here. They're wearing surgical masks and white plastic gloves. As they walk up the beach, they pick up every piece of the rubbish they see, all water bottles, cans, candy wrappers and discarded sandals. They're trying to clean up Dili's beautiful beaches. Gali Suarez Araozu, the coordinator of Movimento Tasimos, explained.
We are young Timorese and we cannot wait for the government to give us a job. But we are taking the initiative to help the government to make our capital beautiful and free of rubbish.
Gali tells me his team has been doing this every weekend in Dili for almost 1 year now. At first, they start off with about 6 people. They made a Facebook page and now they have about 50 members. Every weekend, Gali and his team troll the beach collecting trash. And then they give it to a local NGO called Hapseller. It is the only NGO in the country that focuses on recycling.
Before we start cleaning the beach, first time our team identifies the different types of garbage. After that, we organize the trays and give it to the NGO Hapseller so that it can be recycled and reused.
Linda Geronimo Gutierrez is also here at the beach. Linda is 21 and she say it is important that young people in Timor-Leste start caring about the environment.
Timor-Leste is a new country. As a young woman, I have to come to participate because I want Dili, especially the beach, to be clean and beautiful so that tourists want to visit here. And that will add income too. I hope that the program in Latoya and Nere will
continue to fight in Timor-Leste, the idea of recycling is still very new. People just throw the rubbish away without thinking. Often I walk around Dili, I see people on the train throw the rubbish out the window, or they throw the rubbish by the road, by the river, or wherever they are. So the activities of Movimento Tasimos are very unique here. It's why they have impressed some people in the government. The Forestry and Fisheries Minister, Estancy Lauda Silva, has even started to join them on their weekend clean-ups trolling the beach. He tells me why.
I'm very happy and want to support them and work together, not just on the weekend. Maybe there are other ways we work together to protect our sea ecosystem, to make sure it stays clean.
Timor-Leste is a small nation with a population of 1.1 million. It's also very new. We just gained independence from Indonesia in 1999. The government is trying to find ways to develop new industry, and the minister believes more environmental awareness will help the tourism industry.
When our capital is clean, especially our beach, it will attract tourists to visit our country. And the tourists don't always want to stay in hotels. They like to visit the beach, so we can earn money from that.
The government is also starting to debate about a law to regulate littering. But for now, Movimento Tasimos is leading the way. For Asia Calling, this is Teodosia Dos Reis from Dili, Timor-Leste.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes Store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling to subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.